ranked one of America's top research universities, the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee plays a vital role in shaping the future of Milwaukee and Wisconsin. UWM's diversity, academic excellence, and world-class research contribute to the region's economic development and quality of life. Meet the people behind the creativity and discoveries on UWM today. Here's the host, Tom Lujack, Vice Chancellor of University Relations.
For most of us, going to the local supermarket with a wide selection of healthy choices is just part of our routine. Need something for dinner tonight? The usual answer is, what are you hungry for? It all looks good. But if you're poor, making a decision about what to eat is often a matter of geography. More often than not, your choices are limited to corner grocery stores, stocked with foods high in sugar and fats. On this edition of UWM Today, we talk about those so-called food deserts that are tied to poor nutrition. Our guest is Renee Walker, an assistant professor at UWM's Zilber School of Public Health. Hi, Renee. Good to have you with us today.
Thank you, Tom. It's great to be here.
Food deserts. It is a great term when you begin to think of the problem behind it. They are like islands, aren't they?
Sure, they are. And it's interesting how the concept of food deserts actually came about. There was a time when a lot of the supermarkets and grocery stores were in inner cities. And as they began to expand out to suburban areas because it was cheaper to build there, and then they had larger parcels of land where they can have the coffee shop and the video rental at that time. You know, we had video rentals. And it forced a lot of the stores in the cities to close down, so leaving these areas that no longer had access to affordable and healthy and nutritious foods.
And the end result is that you've got these islands, these stores that still sell things to eat, but not necessarily the selection.
Absolutely. So that's a very good point. And a lot of the stores that remain, some of them do not own the store, so they're at the discretion of the store owners whether or not to have refrigeration, for instance, to provide fresh produce for people to have access to. Additionally, it may not be profitable for the store owners to sell fresh produce for making a profit.
So it's not that you can't buy something to eat in the central city. The question is it good for you?
That is correct. And with my research, a lot of things that we've found is that there's food preference does play a role. And so there are people who say, look, you know, you can put a wide variety of fresh produce in front of me, and I'm not going to eat it because I don't prefer to eat that. Or my children or my grandchildren that I'm raising won't like it. So it is. There are so many factors that are involved. Access is one piece. Preference is another as well.
Well, let's talk about the research that you're involved with at the Zilber School and what you're finding in terms of nutrition and that connection to poverty.
So that's a very good point. And I think if you look at the poverty rates, they're quite high. So nationally, 13.5% of households live in poverty. In the city of Milwaukee, that goes up to 29%. And then when you stratify by race and ethnicity, it's even greater differences, with blacks and African Americans having the highest with 40%, Latinos with 24%. So a lot of these racial ethnic minorities are in higher rates in poverty than compared to other groups. And so what that means are in these neighborhoods where they don't have access to foods, then people rely on fast food restaurants that are in their neighborhoods or the mini marts. And so it makes it a difference because these types of establishments are not known to offer healthy and nutritious foods that are good for a proper diet.
And so what did you find as you talked to people who are living in that area? Is it a matter of them not being familiar with what type of food is good for their system, or have their tastes just adapted to the options that are available to them at these stores and fast food places?
So I think it's a little bit of both. But there's one thing that I did find was that there's such a reliance on food pantries and emergency food assistance programs. So these programs that were really intended to help people perhaps in difficult times have now become chronic, and that people are utilizing them on a day-to-day basis year after year. And so people are going to these food pantries to supplement the foods that they may purchase from the grocery store or community gardens, for instance. So they're certainly, because of the inability to purchase or food buying power that they don't have because of the lack of financial resources, they are relying on emergency food assistance programs.
What's the quality or nature of the nutritional value of food that comes out of those food banks?
So there's great variety, and there's a lot of studies that look to see, are these foods healthy and nutritious? What are they offering? Now, I can tell with my experience, I've gone to these food giveaways primarily in Philadelphia, and it's such an art and a science, and people knew that you can go to one location at 5 o'clock in the morning and leave your bags there to hold your space in line, take a bus and go to another part of town, stand in line and hold your bags there. And what I would go through the food line with them, and there was all kinds of snack cakes. There was produce that was not the best quality. There were some foods that you would have to eat within a day or two. So it was a wide range. In this particular food distribution, they were trying to make sure that people had food to eat, regardless of the quality. And so one can argue, and even in my research, we look at food security, which is the ability of a household to provide food for all members of the family. So the measure of food security looks at the previous 12 months or within a month period, did everyone in the household have enough affordable quality foods to eat? So you have the two debates where some say, well, this just feed people regardless of the quality and the nutritional quality. And others say, look, people should have a way to get food in a way that is dignified and that will lead to productivity.
So is there a different philosophy among the people who run these food banks? You mentioned just make sure that they have something in their stomach versus something good in their stomach. Or is it more a product of the resources available to those who are trying to help out?
So I find that there are two types of ways that food pantries operationalize. And so you do have those that say, look, we are committed to providing healthy and nutritious foods, period. And then others say, you know what, we're going to provide people with foods. We're not going to be paternalistic. We need to get food in people's stomachs. And so you have the two schools, and there's a lot of debate within the literature, and I think there's a lack of consensus on what's the best approach and where to take it from here.
Yeah. So, how did you first become interested in the study of the poor and what they eat?
So I was working, when I was a master's student in Philadelphia, I was working at a health center, and they would have these weekly food giveaways, and I would just sit on the sidewalk, and people would come to me and just tell me their life stories. And I guess I did not have a threatening or official look, you know, as a student. And people would, again, tell me the process of how they would get food for their families. And I was talking to a woman who said she was a diabetic and that she hadn't eaten in 3 days, but it didn't affect her blood sugar. And I'm like, yeah, no, that's probably not very likely. And so I started to frequent this place periodically and actually did my master's thesis there, and just engaging the people and listening to the struggles that they had being lower income and trying to struggle with the debate and the decisions they had to make with whether or not they're going to pay their bills, whether or not they're going to purchase medication or cut their pills, whether or not they're going to buy food. So these struggles and decisions that people had to make really got me interested in looking at how those who are of lower socioeconomic status and limited financial resources were able to obtain food as well as other services.
Have you seen changes over the last several years, and are things getting any better than when you first began looking at this issue?
So, yes, things have gotten better. So I'm glad to say that. And a lot of it had to do with increasing access to health care. You know, that was one way in which people are able to improve, you know, health status, for instance. Also, there seems to be some increase in food pantry donations, although with the Great Recession, there were more and more families relying on those. So there was shortages. But I think since I began this work, there have been some gradual improvements, but we still have a long way to go.
How about schools? What role do school programs have in both keeping kids nourished and also, maybe more importantly, getting them to think about nutrition in the first place?
That's a great question, Tom. And so schools play such an important role because a lot of lower-income children may not have access to foods and healthy and balanced meals when they're at home. So the United States Department of Agriculture has several programs to ensure that children have access to foods. So one is the school breakfast and lunch program that provides food for children during the school hours, so while they're at school. And some of those programs even provide an after-school snack that will likely sustain the child until the next morning. And then also there is the summer food service program, which provides children either low-cost or free meals during school vacations. So certainly an opportunity to educate children about proper diet and nutrition, but children are so reliant on the adults in their lives who purchase food and obtain foods.
Yeah, let's talk about that, what you learn at home. Most of us have our favorite dishes, something that mom or dad prepared, and you have these great memories of that that pork chop that was breaded just the right way, or the fish that was always special at a certain time of year. That culture of eating something that is familiar, is that universal? Creatures of habit when it comes to making our own choices in terms of what is best for us or what we crave the most?
I would say to a certain extent, yes, we are, as you say, creatures of habit, and that we learn our dietary habits and practices from the way we were raised and our parents and grandparents and other family members and other influences. And so I think that a lot of that carries on, but perhaps with there are those who either with education or with opportunity and financial resources can say, you know, maybe the breaded pork chop fried in lard is not the best, so we're going to fry it in olive oil. You know, so people are maybe able to make healthier options as they get older and perhaps have more education, income, and other resources. But a lot is how we were raised and what we saw. And even in the research that I do, I have single mothers primarily say, look, you know, my children are not going to eat the cereal unless it has 100 grams of sugar per serving. And that's what they do. And the reason is that they explain that they would rather their children eat something than nothing at all.
So what is, as a public health expert, what can you do to persuade them that that may not be the best choice?
So one thing that I did, and when I was doing some of my research, I had these focus group-like sessions, and I would always have food there, and I would have some healthier alternatives as well as some what we would call junk food or high-fat, high-calorie, and just allow people to choose. And part of that is I'm interested in seeing, given these options, what are people going to choose? And so when we ran out of the cakes and the cookies, we had granola bars and 100-calorie pack little treats. And people tasted them, says, oh, these aren't that bad. And so it was just interesting to see that when people had options or exposure to different types of food, then they actually had a preference for it. They didn't mind eating that so much. So I think a lot of it is, again, making healthier options and alternatives affordable and available for people.
So you've got these two ends of the age spectrum. You've got the really young kids who are reliant on their parents to feed them and they eat what is put in front of them. And you've talked a little bit about how critical it is that that the moms are making good choices in terms of what goes there. Let's talk about the other end of the spectrum, the people who are older mm-hmm. and poor. Any other resources available to help them than for the rest of the population?
So the United States Department of Agriculture also has a program to assist older adults in terms of providing options and these discounts so they can also obtain healthy and nutritious foods there. So the elderly it's interesting because on one end, for those that are socially isolated, perhaps fear of falls because of limitations in mobility, they may not have the best diet because of fears of going out or being targeted carrying bags of groceries, which was one of the findings from my research studies. But also at the same time, they also may receive Social Security and other forms of income for those that may have a pension. So they have more income, perhaps, that they are able to obtain proper diet and nutrition.
Of course, those who are on reliant on a Social Security check, if that check comes at the beginning of the month and you're 3 weeks, 3.5 weeks into the month, If you have medication to buy and other household needs, you can run out of food.
Very good point, Tom. And that is what I also found from our study findings, is that at the beginning of the month, you know, there was an abundance and people were able to get food. And so older adults spoke about strategies and techniques that they use to make food stretch. So adding water to marinara sauce to make the food stretch, and also frequenting food pantries and their churches would offer food giveaways. So there's still a reliance, even amongst older adults, on emergency food assistance programs.
You're listening to UWM Today here on WUWM. Good to have you with us this week. I'm Tom Lujack, and joining us in the studio is Renee Walker. Renee is an assistant professor at UWM's Zilber School of Public Health, and we're talking about the research she's doing on food and the poor, and why they often don't have even access to the healthy food that is necessary for good health. Renee, talk about the research that that you're engaged in with your other colleagues in terms of regionality. Do you find that some parts of the U.S. Are faring better in terms of helping the poor, both learn how best to eat and feed their kids, versus other parts of the country where you may have more serious problems?
So another great question, Tom. And so I can base that just on the various cities that I've worked in various states, in the Northeast and East Coast. And interestingly, in Boston, although there was a large percentage of the population who were below the poverty line, they did not have the issues of food access as we saw in Philadelphia and Pittsburgh, for example. And one of those reasons is that there was a lot of emergency food assistance programs available. They also had these open markets where store owners can come to sell their produce that was starting to go bad, and you're able to negotiate prices for that. And it was, it was just so many different vendors that were there. They had meats, they had eggs, they had produce, and people were able to get affordable foods and culturally appropriate foods, depending on what their diet and their family's preferences were. And so there we did not see the types of ill effects of malnutrition and undernutrition compared to other places. And additionally, in the literature, for those places that are warmer, where you can garden year-round, or you have more summer months and warmer months, we also don't see the same types of effects that we're seeing in Milwaukee, for instance.
Well, let's grade Milwaukee. How would you put the city on a scale of helping or providing assistance to the poor when it comes to nutrition?
The city of Milwaukee, I will say this, there are some great anti-hunger relief agencies that are doing a lot of great work. So I definitely have to acknowledge the work of Hunger Task Force and Feeding America, for instance. But then there's a lot of some neighborhoods that are doing community gardens to try to increase access as well. So there are efforts to provide food access to people. So I think Milwaukee is doing fairly well in that regard, but I think more of the issue is the poverty piece that we need to address. We see these alarming rates, and addressing poverty can do so much to not just improve food access, but healthcare and education and other types of social ills that we're seeing here.
What about the supermarket scene? Is Milwaukee average when it comes to the number of good food stores located in poorer areas?
I would say no to that. And it's not just Milwaukee. I think this is something, a phenomenon that we're seeing across other urban cities, where food owners have to do an assessment to say, is it going to be profitable for me to move here? So if it's an area where they do not feel that the residents have a strong purchasing power, again, that may not be lucrative for them. And so also in Milwaukee, I had a student that was working with me during similar to a master's thesis, and she was interviewing store owners. And what she said was that the store owner says, look, we are a family-owned business, and we have to be sure that our family members are going to be safe. So there's also perceptions about crime and violence in the city. So the stores don't want to relocate somewhere if they're not going to make a profit and they're not going to feel safe.
Does the same apply to restaurants? In terms of the variety and the type of food that you might find in the central city versus suburbs?
So in the central city, there's more fast food restaurants. and more of the mini marts that you spoke of earlier that tends to offer less nutritious foods. So they tend to be more expensive as it relates to kind of the corner convenience stores. So more expensive, less variety of foods for the people that live in the immediate vicinity compared to the suburbs. Again, when you have larger parcels of land, you can have these larger food stores. You have parking options. People tend to have vehicles that they can get there. So in the city, you're relying on, in many instances, if you don't have a personal vehicle, on a neighbor or a family member to take you to the store or public transportation to get to the store.
So what are the recommendations? What can be done as you look at trying to improve the ability of the poor to both have access to better food and then, very importantly, know what to do with it.
Sure.
In terms of cooking.
Absolutely. So I think there's a lot of policy recommendations that need to be in place. So one is improving transportation options for those that do not have a personal vehicle so they can get to a place where they have a store. I think that it can be policies or incentives for the convenience store owners and the mini mart owners to offer fresh and affordable and nutritious foods that people can get within their immediate neighborhood. So I think that some of those options are there. But again, increasing access to these foods does not necessarily mean increased consumption. So I think that's going to take a concerted effort to perhaps retrain people or exposing people to some of the foods that they may not have had growing up. Or to say, you know, you can eat broccoli raw. It doesn't have to be smothered with cheese sauce, you know, for example. So it is exposure and as well as informing people that there are these options. There is also some concerns about people not having the proper tools that they need to cook fruits and vegetables or vegetables in particular. They may not have a knife sharp enough to cut a vegetable. They may not have the stove or they may be working with a hot plate. So there are these issues as well that kind of impede people from consuming healthier food options.
There is no easy answer.
There is no easy answer, and I wish I had an answer.
Yeah. As you look ahead to your own research, what's next? What are you going to be exploring beyond these immediate questions we've been discussing?
So next steps for me is really designing and implementing these culturally appropriate and patient-centered interventions with diet and nutrition as a health outcome and looking to see how we can improve the quality of life and health outcomes among low-income individuals, families, and communities.
So, for example, as you think about training people, teaching people to be better stewards of the food that they themselves consume, how do you get in front of them? Is it one mouth at a time, or are there other ways to go ahead and begin to change the habits that people have built up over years?
Sure. So people are influenced by their social environment, so by their families, their friends, their church members, you know, their social networks, and so it may be a moot point to just target the individual when there's their children and so many others in their social circles that can either keep them on the right path or that can encourage or discourage them from adopting a new diet or modifying their diet. So it really is taking a larger scale or a larger approach to impact communities as well, which are made up of families and individuals.
And let's come back to schools. You've got a generation of adults whose habits may need to be broken, but you, on the other hand, have this very pliable mind of a 5-year-old, mm-hmm. a 7-year-old who hasn't spent 20 years eating junk food. What can be done in the schools to change the orientation of youngsters to the type of food that they consume or that they would like to consume?
So great question. Schools can have a very important role in terms of having a curriculum to follow to encourage students about or to inform them about the benefits of a healthy diet, proper diet, nutrition, physical activity. And some of that was covered in like your health class once upon a time. But I know that because of cuts and the reduction of hours in the school day and personnel to do that, I know it's been a challenge to do so, but I think that will be a great place or one of the places to start in terms of children to inform them of all of the different options that they may have and to teach them about proper diet and nutrition, perhaps they can go home and share that information with mom and dad.
And how about the lunch programs themselves? Have they evolved? Are they keeping up with offering the new options that are healthier?
So I think that is something that varies from school district to school district. And the work that I did with in Philadelphia with the school meal program was that the foods that they provided to the children were high fat, high calorie. And the reason they went with that option was because they said they didn't know when the children were going to eat again. So they would infuse them with these calories during the school day. And so anecdotally, I know that other school districts are trying to provide more of a well-balanced meal, similar to the MyPlate option with the United States Department of Agriculture, to ensure that there's appropriate servings of fruits, vegetables, whole grains, protein, et cetera.
Boy, there really aren't. There's no magic solution here to fixing the problem. One last area for our listeners who may themselves be making donations to their church or synagogue or community agency food shelters, what would you recommend that we buy when we think about giving back, donating?
So a lot of the websites of the anti-hunger agencies will have a list of products and food items that they are in need of. And so you don't have to wait until November when you see the bins that are at different buildings. I encourage you to support it. There's always looking for non-perishable items, so canned goods, rice, beans, peanut butter. Those are some of the items that I see that are requested the most, but I certainly encourage the listeners to donate to those organizations, if not monetarily, then through the donation of food items.
And as you point out, you don't have to just do it once a year because it's Thanksgiving
that
around the corner.
That is correct.
Well, Renee, thank you very much for sharing the insights into your research. We wish you the best as you continue the good work at the Zilber School of Public Health.
Thank you, Tom, for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Renee Walker, assistant professor at UWM Zilber School of Public Health, our guest on this edition of UWM Today. That's all for this week's program. We'll see you next week at the same time. Take care, everybody. I'm Tom Lujack.
You've been listening to UWM Today with host Tom Lujack, the weekly program where you get to meet the people behind one of America's top research universities, University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. Playing a vital role in shaping the future of Milwaukee and Wisconsin, UWM's diversity, academic excellence, and world-class research contribute to the region's economic development and quality of life. Learn more at uwm.edu.